Hi, my name's Chuck. I invite you to join me for the Emotion Roadmap every fourth Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m., a show where you will learn to take the wheel and control how you feel. The show is about helping you manage emotions, your own, others, and your emotional relationships, especially with those people that matter most to you. I will talk about family issues, including raising children, marital relations, extended family dynamics, and aging, elder care, and caregiving. I will talk about organizational issues, including business and industry, schools, public and private, higher education, local, state, and federal government, hospitals and healthcare, military and religious organizations. I have worked in different ways in all these areas. I will teach you how to use the Emotion Roadmap to address any circumstance involving strong emotions that are complicating your life. I look forward to talking with you every fourth Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
So good! So good! I got you here!
Hello, and welcome back to the Emotion Roadmap, Take the Wheel and Control How You Feel. This is Chuck Wolf, and I'm thrilled to be here with you this week. I'm going to be talking to a person who I'm just so excited to have on our show. His name is Dave O'Brien, and Dave is a play-by-play announcer with the Boston Red Sox. You listen to the radio and you listen to the Red Sox, you're listening to Dave O'Brien. Let me say a little bit about Dave O'Brien. Now, Dave is someone who was actually born in Quincy and has lived back and forth between Massachusetts and New Hampshire a lot. He's done quite a few very interesting things regarding sports. At one time, in 2006, he was the voice of the World Cup. He also has, as I mentioned a moment ago, done NCAA basketball. And he is often doing other baseball programs on ESPN. So not only does he work for the Red Sox as a play-by-play commentator on the radio, but he also is doing a lot, continues to do a lot, with ESPN. Now, he's also worked for some other organizations and some other professional sports teams, but our focus today is Red Sox, because I mentioned this in the past, but again, if you're listening for the first time, I want to just say to you that as someone who believes firmly in sports is a vital part of my life, both playing and watching. I grew up as someone who just adored the Red Sox. Now, I also am in love with the Celtics and the Patriots, but my first love and a very special love has been the Boston Red Sox ever since I was a child. It was instilled in me by my father. It was instilled in me by all my uncles, by my brother and by my cousins. Every male child, and now most and all of the women in our families as well, all seem to really adore the Red Sox. Now, I come from Massachusetts, and that's part of it. But a lot of New Englanders feel the same way. But it's not just New England. Red Sox Nation is a phenomenon that covers the entire universe, it seems. I don't know any other sports team that seems to have the cachet or the name recognition or the interest or the support as the Red Sox do. And because Dave O'Brien has this overview of watching not only the Red Sox, but lots of professional sports teams in many different markets, I want to talk to him a bit about not only the individuals on the team and the slow start, and now they're heating up, and now, you know, they were only going to lose 20 games all season. They've already lost 11. So, they have a fun interview with Dave coming up. But I also want to talk a little bit about what does he think drives this emotional response to the Red Sox. I want to talk about individuals on the Sox. I want to talk about what does it take to make a group feel like a team. What about joining this marketplace? You can play and perform in a fantastic manner in a marketplace where it doesn't get that much press or attention or scrutiny. But you come here to Boston, where people live and die by the Red Sox, and somehow your performance is quite public in a way that you never could imagine until you've actually been in this marketplace. And not everybody can handle that. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the people that are new that have now come to town and how they're doing and what it takes for them to do. I know that some people use sports psychologists to help people make adjustments. I'm actually going to be doing some work with my emotion roadmap, in talking with John Gallagher, the coach from University of Hartford men's basketball team that I interviewed, about the possibility of doing some collaboration. I believe we have so much untapped ability to manage emotions that most of us have no idea about. That I've learned and been privileged to work with the pioneers in the field of emotional intelligence, and to become one of them, and to find a way to help people to understand how to take what we're learning in our laboratories, in our scientific investigations, and make it come alive and make it operational. And I want to talk a bit with Dave about that and what the Red Sox do along those lines. I'd be very interested to hear. So that's it. So we're going to be talking to Dave in just a moment. And before we talk to Dave, I thought I have a tune I'd like you to hear.
Take me out to the ball game.
I am indeed. How are you guys?
Oh, we're good. How are you doing?
Doing okay. It's beautiful out here in Southern California.
Oh, okay. Well, we're delighted to be on. Now, I had said a little bit about you in the beginning, earlier in the show, but what I said about you, just to catch you up to speed and tell you a little bit about our show, Dave, is that we have a show that is about helping people deal more effectively with emotions. One of the things that I have some expertise in is this idea of being more emotionally intelligent. I've been doing a show for a couple of years now that is about, it's called The Emotion Roadmap, Taking the Wheel and Controlling How You Feel. And why I'm tickled to talk to you, Dave, and what I said about you is you have a perspective on sports that's pretty broad, and yet you also have that unique view of the Red Sox. I know you grew up in Quincy, I guess, in New Hampshire, and I grew up
in
Massachusetts.
Yep, I'm about as New England as you can get in that regard.
So, you know, it's kind of like instilled in you to be a Red Sox fan. I don't choose to not feel that compelling, powerful urge to want to support the Red Sox if you're there. So you grew up with that, but you also then, I guess you've done the World Cup. You've broadcast Barry Bonds when he hit that record-breaking home run, and you just did the NCAA's Final Four. So you've got a pretty wide perspective on sports, as I understand it.
Yeah, I would have to say that's true, and I hope a healthy perspective on it, getting a chance to do college basketball and, you know, being around younger people and younger athletes, but certainly in a high-octane environment as NCAA basketball is. And Major League Baseball, this is my 21st season calling Major League Baseball, the last five with the Red Sox on radio, but with ESPN doing the game of the week on Wednesday nights as well. So I certainly travel a great deal and get a chance to see the best, what I consider the best sports, not only in the country but in the world. So just very fortunate, very lucky. And you're right about the Red Sox thing as well, because, you know, I grew up with it. I was born into it. But it's sort of a dream come true for me to be able to call Red Sox games, to go into Fenway Park on a nightly basis and call that my office, you know, high above home plate on Yawkey Way there. That's a dream come true for me.
You know, that's really rich. I was saying earlier that I have a three-day-old grandson right now that I'm very excited about that. That's the real excitement in my life at the moment. And, you know, I didn't want to see him pushy, so I went to the second day of his birth to put a Red Sox cap on him.
There you go.
Yeah. So
me too.
India has
absolutely no choice. You know, it's going to be the Sox or nothing for the rest of your grandson's life. It's beautiful.
Well, you know, but you have to understand that he lives in Chicago, and his father is a Dodgers fan. He grew up in California. But he always liked the Red Sox. He always liked the Red Sox. And, you know, that's the other thing I wanted, you know, there's a lot of things I guess I'd like to ask you about. But one of the things is this, you see lots of sports teams, not just baseball teams, but lots of teams. And yet one of the things that strikes me and this is kind of a cute story I told my daughter when she moved to Chicago. When she first moved out to Chicago, she was feeling a little bit alone, and she went to a Chicago White Sox-Red Sox game, and she was sitting in the stands, and she called me with the cell phone when she was in the stands, and she, you know, she was feeling a little lonely, but she said, you know, Dad, the funniest thing, I've got all these people around me are Red Sox fans. I can't believe how many Red Sox fans there are at Chicago Stadium. I said to her, I said, Becky, as long as you're part of Red Sox Nation, you'll never be alone.
How true it is. You know, even here in California, as the Red Sox are playing the Angels right now in this 40-game series, and tonight is Game 3, it is remarkable when David Ortiz rips a double or John Lester strikes somebody out, the reaction inside Angel Stadium. Now, this is 3,000 miles away, clearly on the other side of the country, but you still have probably at least, I'd say, 40% Red Sox fans in the stands. And you know what it's like whenever the Red Sox go to Baltimore or go to, you know, even San Diego. I remember a few years ago playing an interleague series in San Diego, California, a National League city. And Red Sox Nation totally and completely took over that town for that weekend series. There's nothing like it, and I don't care how many Yankee fans step up and say, well, it's the same with the Yankees wherever the Yankees play. It is not. The Red Sox have been the top road draw in Major League Baseball for, I think, three of the last 4 years. Only one time did the Yankees exceed them in road attendance, and I just think that's absolutely remarkable. It wasn't that way when you and I were kids, but it certainly is now.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that New York seems to be such a place from where so many people seem to emanate from, and that when you find Yankee fans in other places, it's almost somehow either they've lived there or they have lots of relatives living in New York. But Red Sox fans, they don't have to have that connection. They just somehow have embraced the team, and that's an amazing phenomenon.
I'm not exactly sure when that happened, and you might have a better guess on this than I, but I'm thinking it really started in 2003, before the World Series year, because remember how the Red Sox lost in 03 on the Aaron Boone home run at Yankee Stadium off Tim Wakefield in Game 7, the famous game where Pedro Martinez should or should not have gone out to continue to pitch, and I thought, that's probably where it started, because the Red Sox continued their underdog and rather tragic history, and then the very next year won the World Series, and that remarkable American League Championship Series come from behind against the Yankees. That solidified that fan base. I think the new wave of Red Sox fans who had sort of gotten a taste of that tragedy, capped by the overwhelming joy of winning a World Championship finally after 86 years.
Well, I actually, the game that you talked to, of course, brings up a horrible memory, in 2003. But it's actually, in the work that I do in emotional intelligence, it's kind of funny. I use the example of that day when everybody knew that Pedro Martinez should have been pulled from the game, and it cost Grady his job as the manager of the team. For whatever reason, he didn't want to bring in a reliever, even though he'd done it all season and it worked all season. In that game, I don't know anybody that cared and adored and loved the Red Sox that could go to sleep that night after that game. And I ended up with my eyes wide open at 2 o'clock in the morning, and one of the things I remembered, this is kind of a funny thing, but in emotional intelligence, in the science, one of the things that you learn is that negative emotions are really helpful for doing detailed work. It's a curious thing, but if you think about it, when you have to do like a spreadsheet or something like that, I mean, you might even like spreadsheets, but you have to be really focused and intense. And
right.
A slightly sad or even an angry, but not overly angry, but if you recognize when you're in a negative frame of mind, it's a good time to do detailed work. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I got out of bed and did 4 hours of detailed work. I knew I wasn't going to sleep that night.
Yeah, probably that negative emotion and that wave of negativity powered you for months,
all through that
winter. But it was a horrifying time. And I can remember being on the phone with my father in 1986. Living in South Carolina, just starting my sports announcing career, and we were on the phone during the World Series, during Game 6 against the Mets, when they were already chilling the champagne in the Shea Stadium clubhouse. The Red Sox were so close to a World Championship, they could taste the champagne. And then, of course, it all fell apart there in Game 6. Mookie Wilson and all that, and the Mets Mets rallied and eventually won the World Series. But I can remember during Game 6 being on the phone with my father. He was up in New Hampshire. And when that final run crossed the plate in that Met rally, neither one of us said a word, and we simply hung up the phone. And I didn't think I'd ever recover from that. And I know you probably felt the same way, and all of us who love the Red Sox, we figured this was it. This was our Armageddon. It couldn't get any worse. And then in 03, it actually felt worse because it was the Yankees. And, you know, for it to flip the way it did from 04 on, where the Red Sox, you know, expect to win a championship every single year, is pretty remarkable. I mean, now we're to the point where we're getting spoiled a little bit. Not necessarily with the start this year's club got off to, which was thoroughly unexpected, but the team's rallying now, playing much, much better, winning 6 out of 7, and the ship has been righted, I think. And, you know, most things are okay now in Red Sox Nation, whereas, you know, 2 weeks ago it looked pretty dismal.
Well, I actually listened to, you know, to get ready for this interview, I listened to you give an interview on, it's on the internet still. I think it was the first day that Texas game, the first Texas game, and how you thought they might only lose 20 games all season, I think, or something like that.
Well, I don't know if I said 20, but I think I put it at 100 wins is something certainly this team should shoot for as a realistic goal. And you know what? I really don't think we back off on that. I think, you know, the way the pitching's been lately, particularly with Josh Beckett looking like a vintage Josh Beckett and Lester throwing the ball really well, even Daisuke stepping up and throwing a gem on Patriots Day, you know, and the offense, to me, hasn't even clicked yet. Carl Crawford really hasn't gotten going yet. Adrian Gonzalez really hasn't gotten going yet. Uke has been cold really since the first day of spring training. When those guys start swinging the bats, and coupled with this pitching, there's every reason to believe the Red Sox, even with that dismal start, should be approaching that 100-win mark, I think. I don't think there's nothing I've seen that makes me think otherwise.
Well, let me make a couple comments on things you just said. First of all, I think for me at least, the time that the Red Sox changed and became like the whole idea of like everyone in the land looking at them was 1967 in the Impossible Dream. I was going to school in Boston at that time, and I remember you used to be able to go down in the seventh inning, and they used to let you in for free because there were no sellouts then. And they used to be able to go up and stand in the bleachers or sit in the bleachers and watch the games. And they were, and in 67, most of the games that they won were won in the eighth or ninth inning. It was the most amazing experience. Up until 2004, that was the most amazing Red Sox experience, for, you know, in terms of anything that I watched that was, for the most part, pleasurable to the very end. But even then, that World Series against the Cardinals was an amazing World Series. I got to see one of those games. But the other thing I wanted to say something about, because I did want to talk about this, you look at performance, and it's funny because in the Boston Globe today, I was looking read it anyway online, and Dustin Pedroia said, this is a couple of quotes from him, he said, "That's why it's not about how you feel." This is from Pedroia today. "You can wake up one day and be sore and hurting and your swing feels like crap, but the only thing that matters is how you perform. That's what Boston is all about." Now, having said that, what I think he's saying is it does matter how you feel, it's not how you physically feel, because emotionally you have to feel like you've got that ability. And Pedroia, I mean, to me, you know, when my grandson grows up, I hope when he's playing ball, he's playing like Petey is. You know, he's got that incredible drive to succeed, and no matter, you know, against all obstacles. But then you have a guy like Kyle Crawford come in. Now, I don't feel the same way about Gonzalez. But, you know, for Kyle Crawford, I think, you know, with a big paycheck, the amazing potential, everybody thinking he's going to be a superstar right out of the gate, and can he perform on this stage in front of this many people with this kind of pressure? And I think emotionally, I mean, to me, a lot, I look at something like what's going on for him, and I think there's an emotional issue. But before I ask you to respond to that one, I also want to ask you about a couple others. For Uke, one of the things that struck me for Kevin Youkilis was he was a Gold Glove first baseman. He hit in the 300s with a lot of RBIs for power every year, and whenever they talked about bringing somebody in, they keep talking about bringing in a first baseman. You know, whether it was Teixeira before, and now it was Gonzalez. And it's like, Uke is back at third base now, and he says he's fine with it. But to me, I'm wondering if there's a little bit of an emotional upheaval in moving from first base, where he got so comfortable and so good, back over to third. So that's what the,
it's an interesting point, because he won a Gold Glove over there. And turned himself into, you know, arguably the premier first baseman defensively in the American League. certainly right there with Teixeira, and then having to move across the diamond. Yeah, you wonder if there's just some lag in the adjustment or what it might be. And really, defensively, I think Uke has actually scuffled a little bit, but I thought he always considered himself a third baseman. You know, that's how he came up, as an other side of the diamond infielder. He really had to learn first base, and obviously learned it very, very well. But it's interesting when you talk about the emotions and the expectations that a player not necessarily puts on himself, but are placed on him. And when does he feel that? When does it kick in? You know, for Carl Crawford, it seemed immediately that he sensed, hey, the game has changed. I'm not in Tampa Bay anymore. I'm not playing in front of 14,000 people on a good night anymore. I'm playing in front of a packed house that has high expectations. And you could see right away Carl Crawford holding that bat so tight he was making sawdust out of the handle when he would get in the batter's box. And he's not over that yet. He's still swinging at pitches he shouldn't swing at. Now, you got to look at the track record of an athlete and say eventually it's going to kick. It's going to kick in for Nicholas. It's going to kick in for Carl Crawford. The fact that we're well into the first month and it hasn't happened yet is fascinating to me, too. And when does that change? Does it change because he works really hard in the cage, in Crawford's case, which he's doing? You know, you see him come out of the batting cages, just sweat pouring off him hours before the game. Do you try to outwork the problem, or is it something else? You know, do you let yourself up emotionally? And do you say, look, I know I'm going to be able to perform. I know I'm going to hit 300. I know I'm going to make a run at 60, 70 stolen bases. I'm going to drive in close to 90 runs because that's what I have done throughout my career. And physically, I'm still the same guy. Sometimes it takes just speaking to the right person. In Carl's case, he's talking to his dad now. He's talking to his old high school coach to try and find out, am I doing anything different in the box? Fundamentally, have I changed something? Is that the reason I'm off to such a slow start? But I kind of agree, and I think this is where you're heading with Crawford, that his problem is from the neck up, you know, not the rest of his physical body. He's got to get right with where he is in the red side. You know, first of all, maybe hitting in one spot for more than a couple days in a row would do him a lot of good. He's been jumping up and down in that lineup, and that's a comfort zone thing for a player. He needs to be comfortable. He needs, you know, if he wants to hit third, I say let him hit third. If he wants to bat second, if he doesn't want to lead off ever again this season, I say don't put him there. But, you know, there's a lot of that goes on with athletes and with managers and organizations. Where do I fit? What's my comfort zone in order to perform? Because so much of what a pro athlete does, as you know, is confidence. It's confidence, showing up knowing today's going to be a good day.
I work with emotions just like this, David. I think about what somebody is feeling, and you're never reflective when things are fine. It's only when there's a problem. So if there's a problem, you stop and you step back and you say, okay, so what is it that either Crawford or anybody is feeling? And then you ask, what would be ideal to feel? And you try to set the ideal, which what you just said was confidence. And one of the things that Pedroia said that I think is an ideal attitude for an athlete to have, this was another quote he said. He said, in my rookie year, they were booing me. And I thought it was great. I wasn't playing good. It's just what they demand out of their players. You never want to get booed, obviously, but they care so much. They care about every game, and that makes it fun. Now, how many guys could say that makes it fun?
Yeah.
You could have everybody with Pedroia's headset.
And you made this point earlier, he's always had the chips stacked against him because he's 5'7", if he's anything. He's probably even shorter than that. He's always had detractors, probably going back to Little League. So you can absolutely hear Dustin Pedroia say that. Get on me a little more. Doubt me a little more. I mean, this is a guy who uses those slights and holds a little bit of a grudge occasionally. He kept a running list of people who had doubted him publicly, either in print or on the air, a few years ago. And if you ask him today, you know, hey, who were those people? Do you remember their names? He might look at you and go, yeah, you were one of them, you know, to a writer. But that's the fuel that he needs, you know. And so, yeah, he's got that chip on his shoulder. It's one of the things that makes him a great player, aside from the fact that he has an incredible desire to win and to beat you. That's off the charts. It's as high as any competitive will I've ever seen in an athlete. And plus, he has a great deal of talent, which certainly doesn't hurt. He doesn't lack for confidence. He knows today he's better than you are. when he goes on the field. He may not feel 100%. He might not feel great on a given day. But, I mean, just the other night here in Anaheim, and this is a great example of what you're talking about. He slid into second base. He jarred his foot. The foot he fractured last year. He still has a screw in that foot. It looked like he was going to have to come out of the game. He absolutely willed his way to stay in that game and then wound up having one of the best individual games I've seen in a few years from somebody not named Josh Hamilton. I mean, he won that game with his legs. He won that game with his head. He made a great throw from the right field line to throw out Ibar at third base, which was the play of the game defensively. He also had three hits in that game. He's just so much fun to watch. But it's interesting, the psychology of watching Dustin Pedroia play and what he needs to do in order to play at that level. It's, I think, different from Carl Crawford, and it's different from Mark Teixeira and Alex Rodriguez. They're all different how they get to that place of peak performance.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that strikes me about that is, in the way I think about this, the work that I do, Dave, is that I think you have to understand, number one, in the science of how emotions work. That's part of it. But you also have to find the right key for that individual that you're talking to. And that's what you just said. I mean, it is true. It is different for everybody. I mean, you'd love to have everybody feel as though, you know what, bring it on. I know who I am. I know how good I can be. And I'm going to get there. And I'm very confident. And I have that confidence no matter what's happening. But a lot of guys don't. And then it's not just, you know, Kyle's like a current example. But a lot of people come to either New York or to Boston, and the performance is so incredibly intense. They, you know, they're so visible. It's so public. There's such scrutiny. It's something that not everybody can really live with comfortably. And yet, for me at least, I think that we have such untapped potential emotionally that we just don't know how to leverage. And that when you say it's from the neck up, that's the work that I do. That's what this whole show is about, really. But I want to ask you about another one, because you got Curt Young, who's the Red Sox pitching coach, brand new, and you got Red Sox pitchers who are maybe Philadelphia might have a better starting rotation, but maybe not. And maybe the Red Sox are the best starting rotation in all of baseball, and you've got all of them losing right out of the gate, and you've got a new pitching coach. And how long do you support, you know, somebody like, how does he deal with it as a coach?
Well, it's a great point about Curt Young, and that's not a guy that I know particularly well yet. We're still trying to get to know Curt and how he does things. But, you know, in his position, he has to be like Terry Francona. He has to be the captain of the ship, at least on the pitching side of things, and, you know, not run it up against the rocks and not hit an iceberg and not overreact to what people might be saying. You really have to be able to turn a blind eye and ear and say, you know, that doesn't matter. If we get off to a bad start, it's only 1 month or it's only a handful of starts. If he had overreacted and started doing things differently when the starting rotation got out of the gate so slowly, when Clay Buchholz got knocked around, when Lester had a couple of bad outings and Daisuke, you know, and started changing routines and started, you know, making accusations and trying to fend off blame and all of those things, it could have been a disastrous thing. Now you look at the Red Sox over the last six or seven outings, nobody's allowed more than one earned run, any particular starter. So simply by, you know, staying the course and not overreacting, it's found its level. The Red Sox pitching staff has found its level, which is a very high level. I always thought that was one of the great things about Terry Francona and his ability to stay patient and not overreact. It's better than any manager I've ever seen of any professional sport or any college team that I've ever been around. He's remarkable. He always takes a long-range view, and I think it has a calming influence inside of that clubhouse. So, I'm going to break away and let you guys go, because I have to run and get to the ballpark myself to start preparing for tonight's broadcast.
Can I ask you one thing as a favor before you go?
Sure.
Real quick. Yeah. Would you mind saying, I'm going to as something? I'll tell you in a second about my grandson. As if, and that, what I'd ask you to say is, if you were broadcasting, Dave, that say hello to Sonny Styles. That's my grandson's name. The new Red Sox shortstop, now batting third.
What was the first name again?
Yeah, Sonny Styles.
Sonny Styles. Now, that's a great baseball name right there. That's,
I know.
That's terrific right there. So, right. So say hello to Sonny Styles, the new Red Sox shortstop, batting third.
I'm so happy, Dave. You made my day. Thanks a million.
My pleasure. Have a great great day, and let's see if the Sox can grab another win tonight.
Yeah, they're playing great, and I'm glad you're out there on broadcast, and I look forward to watching the results tonight. Thanks, Dave.
Appreciate it very much. Take care.
You too. That was great.
That was intense.
A big thank you to Pam Ganley for helping to set that up, and for Dave O'Brien for saying hello to Sunny Styles. I love that. And Lou, thank you so much for your help with this. It was great, and take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Congratulations, Chuck, and play ball. That's what I say, play ball.